I do not yet know what the choir of angels sounds like, but I don't think they will improve on what I've just heard. This was marvelous. Thank you. It's a treat to be with you this weekend. I have been deeply moved by the hospitality given to me, the welcome that has been extended to me. And it is good to get better acquainted with you, Peter. And I do pray God's great wisdom and grace for you as you continue to serve this strategic and historic congregation. I invite you this morning and this evening to come with me into the world described in the 15th chapter of the Gospel according to Luke. Many have called Luke 15 the Gospel within the Gospel, and for good reason. For in this chapter, we have the Gospel in pure form, so to speak, especially in the parable of the prodigal father. Many of you have no doubt read this chapter and, like me, want to hear it read again and again. Many preachers have preached this chapter many times, but like me, long to preach it again and again. The story Jesus tells has redemptive power in any cultural setting: Canadian, British, American, Mexican, African, Chinese. But the story really comes alive and has its redemptive purpose in us when it is heard in the original cultural context in which Jesus first taught it, in the Middle Eastern context in which he first taught it. Ready? Luke 15, verse 1. Now all the tax gatherers and sinners were coming near Jesus to listen to him. And both the Pharisees and scribes began to grumble, saying, "This man welcomes sinners, and he eats with them." And so Jesus told them this parable and goes on to tell the parable of the shepherd and his lost sheep, the woman and her lost coins, and the father and his lost sons. Now, whenever we read Jesus' story, we must remember that Jesus first taught it to scribes and Pharisees, not to the crowds. First taught to scribes and Pharisees, not to the crowds. And we need to remember that Jesus told these stories to justify actions which the scribes and Pharisees considered to be scandalous, to justify actions which the religious leaders judged to be shameful. Who are these scribes and Pharisees with whom Jesus is always in trouble? The scribes are the professional theologians of the day. They're the seminary professors, the ecclesiastical lawyers, the bishops, and the district superintendents. They were entrusted with the task of teaching and protecting the law of God and all the traditions built up around that law. And it was incumbent upon their office to question the teaching of this new rabbi. The Pharisees are the devout lay leaders of the day. They're the deacons and the elders. They're the Sunday school teachers and the committee chairpersons. They were committed to keeping and obeying God's law and the 631 other regulations built up around the basic Ten Commandments. Now, although the scribes and Pharisees tend to get pretty bad press, we should not too quickly dismiss them, for they were well-motivated people. They wanted to be holy. They wanted to be pleasing to a living God, and they wanted to help other people be holy. The problem was their concept of holiness. For them, holiness meant conformity to the rules. One achieves holiness by keeping rules and regulations. They missed the point. Holiness cannot be legislated. Holiness comes from relationship, relationship with a holy God. And that relationship cannot be achieved or maintained by keeping rules and regulations. Now, here's the critical point to keep in mind whenever we're looking at Jesus' story. The scribes and Pharisees thought of themselves as the protectors of the reputation of Israel's law, and thereby the protectors of the reputation of Israel's God. And as far as they were concerned, Jesus of Nazareth was shaming that reputation. Jesus was shaming the name of a holy God. At issue for them was the nature and character of a holy God. Now, who are these sinners and tax collectors with whom Jesus is always keeping company? The tax collectors were Jews who collected taxes for the Roman Empire. They bought the right to collect tax in a particular environment, and as long as they paid the Romans the agreed-upon amount, they could tax the Jews all they wanted to. So that meant the tax collectors were ripping off their fellow Jews. The word sinners is the Pharisees' word. It may interest you to know that Jesus never addressed a human being with the word sinner. It refers to the people who broke the law. Such people were considered unclean. They were ostracized by those who thought they were keeping the law. And sinners and tax collectors flocked to Jesus. That's an understatement. They wanted to be near this rabbi from Nazareth. And scandal of scandals, Jesus wanted to be near them. Jesus received them and welcomed them. The word that Luke uses literally means welcome into fellowship, welcome as a member of one's family. Jesus was welcoming tax collectors and sinners as members of his own family. But what really scandalized the religious leaders was that Jesus ate with sinners and tax collectors. He ate with them. In the Middle East, to eat a meal with someone meant a whole lot more than it does in our time. To eat a meal with a person in the Middle East then and today is a sacramental act signifying total acceptance. Total acceptance. Scandal of scandals. This man welcomes sinners and he eats with them. The leaders say this out of disgust and anger. Jesus of Nazareth is shaming the law of Israel and thereby shaming the God of Israel. Shaming, shaming, shaming. Jesus then responds to this accusation by telling the parables recorded in Luke 15. They are often called the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost sons. And that's too bad, because the subject of the story is not who or what is lost, but whose is lost. The story is not about the lost sheep, but about the shepherd. Not about the lost coins, but about the woman. Not about the lost sons, but about the father. And here is the most important point to keep in mind as we read these parables. Through these parables, Jesus is painting a portrait. He's painting a portrait of the living God whose reputation the scribes and Pharisees are so zealous to protect. Here, the incarnate God, the one who can say, "Those who have seen me have seen the Father," paints a picture of the Father. The one who knows the Father, who comes from the Father, who abides in the Father, now draws a picture of the Father and draws us into the Father's heart. Which is why these parables have such a powerful effect on us in any cultural setting. In the feelings of the shepherd for his sheep and his actions toward the sheep, in the feelings of the woman for her coin and her actions toward the coin, in the feelings of the father for his sons and his action toward his sons, we are discovering who the Father is and what the Father is like. This is so important to grasp. The subject of these stories is the holy God whose reputation scribes and Pharisees are anxious to protect. And it turns out that through these parables, Jesus makes matters worse. He heightens the scandal. Let me show you. Luke 15, verse 11. There was a man who had two sons. This tells us that we will not understand this parable until we have dealt with both of the sons. The fact is, the parable is addressed for the benefit of the second son. Both sons, it turns out, leave their father, the younger son by going to the far country, the older son by staying home. The younger son says to his father, verse 12, "Father, give me the share of the wealth that falls to me." That's a very cruel thing to say. It's as though he had said, "Look, Father, why don't you just give me the wealth that'll be mine when you die?" Dr. Kenneth Bailey, a Presbyterian theologian and missionary, spent most of his life in the Middle East, particularly in Lebanon and in Syria. And in his book, The Cross and the Prodigal, he points out that such a request, "Give me my inheritance," was unheard of in the Middle East. It was unimaginable. In village after village, he would ask villagers, "Has anyone made such a request in your village?" And the uniform answer was no. And then he would ask, "If anyone did make such a request, what would happen?" And the uniform answer was, "Why, the father would beat him, of course." "Why?" he would ask. "Because the request means he wants the father to die." When I lived in the Philippines, I had the privilege of working through this parable with the Ifugao people of the northern part of the Philippines, the original Filipinos. And when I asked them, "Would you ever have such a request in your village?" they said, "No, it's unimaginable." "What if one of your sons asked for this?" "Why, the father would beat him, of course." What a self-centered, demanding, rebellious, ungrateful son. "Father, give me, give me." That's the keynote of his conversation with his father. "Give me my share of the estate." Here we discover the nature of sin. Sin is not breaking the law, although that is involved. Sin is breaking a relationship. At the beginning of the story, the younger son has not broken any rules, but he has broken his father's heart. And as we see tonight, the second son breaks his father's heart even more deeply. Now, how does this father, portrayed by Jesus, respond to this younger son's cruel request? In a surprising way. As the villagers of the Middle East told Kenneth Bailey, they expect the father to beat his son. But what does the son portrayed by Jesus do? Surprise, he grants the request. Verse 12, he divided his wealth between them. The father gives the younger son one-third of the family's wealth. One-third, and he lets the son go. Here we discover something about the love of God. It is not possessive. Love gives the freedom to refuse to be loved. There are times when God lets us have our way. There's another surprise in the father's response. At this point in the story, Middle Easterners expect the father to at least say something like, "Okay, then you're no longer my son." But this father does not say that. And in so doing, he is choosing to suffer even more deeply. He's opening himself up to even greater pain. Remember, Jesus is painting a portrait of the holy God whose reputation scribes and Pharisees are jealous to protect. The younger son then gathers together all of his belongings and sets off for the far country. The word translated "gather together" in verse 13 should be rendered "turned into cash." He liquidates all of his assets. And he liquidates the assets so he can travel more lightly. He goes from house to house, shop to shop, selling his father's stock in Bethlehem steel and Arabian oil and Dead Sea fish and chips and Jerusalem.com. Notice that Jesus says the son does this quickly. Verse 13, quickly, not many days later. The reason for the haste is not simply that he wants to get on with the journey. Rather, as Kenneth Bailey suggests, as he goes from prospective buyer to another, the intensity of the community hatred begins to build. The disgust mounts. At every turn, he's greeted with amazement and horror and rejection. Shame on you, shame on you, shame on you. And he needs to leave the village for his own safety. Now, this part of the cultural context will become very important later in the story. The son leaves. He goes to the far country, far from his people, and squanders all this wealth in loose living. Loose living is a biblical euphemism for wine, women, and song. He lives high on the hog, though I suppose as a Jewish boy he wouldn't put it exactly that way. The son lives so loosely that he loses one-third of the family wealth. One-third of the family wealth. And then a famine hits. Thank God that it does not go well in the far country. Thank God that when he lets us have our way, it does not go well. When the son had lots of money, he had lots of friends. When the money was gone, he had no friends, and he was in need. Now, why not go home? He eventually does go home, but why not, when the famine comes, why does he not go home? Because he's afraid to go home. Why is he afraid to go home? For one thing, he will have to face the taunting and jesting of the villagers as he comes through the gate. So you went off to make your fortune, did you? And look at you now, hungry and dirty and a total failure. He cannot, at that point, contemplate enduring such shame. Furthermore, he's afraid to go home because he's afraid of the anger and the hostility of the elders of the village. They might beat him. They might make things so hard on him that he will starve in the village. When I asked the Ifugao people of the Philippines, what would you do if one of these sons came back? They said, well, we would starve him, of course. Furthermore, he does not choose to go home because at this time he does not want to bear the scorn of his older brother. The older brother might say, you lousy, good-for-nothing bum, you wasted one-third of the family wealth. You have no right here. Or if he had any mercy at all, he might say something like, you blew it, get it back. When you've recovered the wealth, then you can come home. I often wonder how many younger siblings don't come home because of such older siblings. Scribes and Pharisees, if they let you come home at all, demand that you first measure up. And the younger brother will endure the famine before facing such shame before his brother. But there's another reason why the son does not get up at that point, why he's afraid. He's afraid of his father. Afraid of the father? He fully expects the anger and scorn and punishment and rejection of the father. The father has every right to feel and so act. He has every right to forget his son. He has every right to say to his son, you made your bed, now you sleep in it. So the son chooses to stay in the far country. He goes to a citizen of the country, a Gentile, says Jesus, and he begs for work. Here's an interesting point to note. The word translated, he attaches himself to the Gentile in verse 15, literally means he glued himself. The picture is one of desperation. He is forcing himself on that citizen. I'll do anything. And it's possible the citizen doesn't want to help him, and so offers him a job that he assumes a Jewish boy will reject. Go feed the pigs. Pigs were considered the garbage collectors of the village. Yet the son is so desperate, he takes the job. The situation begins to worsen. He would gladly eat whatever anyone would put before him, but no one gave him anything to eat, not even pig food. So Jesus says he finally came to his senses. Verse 17, and he says, how many of my father's hired men have food enough to eat, and I am starving to death? Question. What is it that made this boy come to his senses? Just his need? Dale Bruner, who taught theology at a seminary in the Philippines, helped me understand what was going on here. He says that what makes this boy come to his senses is the memory of the Father. He remembers the goodness of the Father of whom he's afraid. How many of my father's hired hands have food enough to eat? He remembers that his father was generous to his own employees and workers. What a memory. May my children have such a memory of me. So the younger son reasons to himself, like, what am I doing here? I'll get up, I'll go home, and I'll be asked to be a hired hand. I'll face the taunting and the scorning, but at least I will not starve. So off he goes, ragged, weary, needing a bath, and nothing left of the family inheritance. As he walks home, he puts together a speech. It's in verses 18 and 19. And this speech has three parts. And I can imagine him practicing his speech as he went home. Part one, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. Part one is his confession of sin. He knows that what he has done is not right. Part two, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Part two is his affirmation of the consequences of sin. He realized that he's broken the relationship. He realizes that he has no right to sonship anymore. Part three, make me to be one of your hired men. Part three is his offer to make up for his sin, to try to atone for his sin. Review the speech. It's important to see. It has three parts. Part one, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. Part two, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Part three, make me to be one of your hired men. I imagine him saying it over and over and over and over again. Father, I've sinned against heaven and your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me to be one of your hired men. Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me to be one of your hired servants. And then we come to the heart of the story. Remember why Jesus is telling the story. He is justifying or interpreting his own behavior, which scribes and Pharisees consider to be scandalous. And at this point, the scribes and Pharisees are listening very carefully. Jesus says, verse 20, but while the son was a long way off, yes, Jesus, while the son was a long way off, the father saw him. Surprise! Everyone in that day expected the father to have forgotten his son, to have lost his son in his work. But no, not this father. This father has been longing for his son. He has been looking and waiting every day, longing for his son, which is why Helmut Thielicke, the great German preacher, theologian, entitled his book on the parables, The Waiting Father. The Waiting Father. What a picture of the holy God Jesus is painting. While the son was a long way off, the father saw him. Do you believe the father sees you? Do you believe the father sees your children or grandchildren, some who may be in the far country? Jesus continues, verse 20. And the father felt compassion for him. Another surprise. Everyone in that day expected scorn, disgust, and indignation. They expected the father to say, the son blew it. He just wouldn't listen to me. He wouldn't listen. He had to have his way. Well, let him have his way. But no, this father is filled with compassion. The actual word Luke uses refers to the innards of the person, to the guts. The father's deeply moved. He's ripped up in guts for his son. What a picture of the holy God Jesus is painting, the suffering father. Jesus continues, verse 20. And the father ran toward his son. Another surprise. The father ran in the Middle East or Asia. A man of the Father's age and stature never runs for any reason. To run in public is a shameful act because it means lifting your robe and exposing your underwear. It's a shameful act. The Father ran. Literally, Jesus said, he raced. The Father raced to the Son. What a picture of the Holy God, the running Father. Can you see him running for you, running for your children, running for your grandkids, running for the people of this community? Why run? Well, because he's anxious to see his son. But here's now where the culture comes into play. The father knows what his son is going to face once he gets to the village gates. He knows that once this son gets to the gates, he's going to be heckled and humiliated. He knows that the elders might even begin to stone him. And so the father runs to head it all off. Shameful act. Don't you love this story? Jesus continues in verse 20. And the father embraced him and threw his arms around him and kissed him. It's literally kept kissing him, kept again and again. What a scandalous picture Jesus is painting of the Holy God. The father should have remained distant at the coming of his son. He should have stayed back at this kid who squandered a third of the family wealth, who shamed the father's name in the name of the family, in the name of the village. But Jesus knows a different kind of father. This father has been waiting and longing and suffering. And when he saw his son, he ran to him, embraced him, and kissed him, filthy though he may be. Now get this. By that act, kissing his son, the father takes upon himself all the shame of his son. The father transfers all the shame of his son to himself. And now, whatever it was that the elders and villagers and older son wanted to do to the younger son, they must do to the father. While stunned by this surprising, scandalous love, the son gives his speech. Remember, it has three parts. The son begins, verse 21, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. The father lets him say it. God lets us say that. He lets us make our confession. It's important to do. The son continues, part 2, verse 21, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. The father lets him say that too, because he needed to acknowledge what had happened. God lets us say this because it means we know that sin has broken the relationship. And there's a third part. Remember what it was? Make me to be one of your hired men. The son takes a deep breath, ready to say the third part. But before he can say the third part, the father surprises him again. The father interrupts the son's speech with his own speech. And that interruption is the gospel. The father cuts off part 3. He will not hear it. We can say it, but he will not hear it. It is irrelevant. He will not let us offer to make up for our sin. He will not let us propose a way to pay the debt. How could we? How could we anyway? God will not let us try to earn our way back in the family. Oh, we do it all the time, don't we? We get busy doing all kinds of good deeds. We give ourselves to intense religious ritual. We wallow in guilt, feeling like if we feel miserable enough, God will finally welcome us. The father interrupts the son before the son can give part 3 of his speech because there's nothing the son can do but come home. That's all God wants. Come to our senses, turn around, and come home. Part 3 of the son's speech is cut off by the father's speech, and what the father says is full of surprises. Everyone expects him to say, go get a shower, kid, and put on some decent clothes. But not this father. Verse 22, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. The best robe? the best robe is the father's robe. Surprise! The prodigal son is now going to enter the village wearing the father's robe. What a picture of the holy God, the father who dresses prodigal sons and daughters, the holy God who clothes unholy sinners with his own holiness, who covers my rags with his robe. Oh, I love to tell the story. 'Twill be my theme in glory. There's more, another surprise. Quick, put a ring on his finger. The ring is the so-called signet ring. This is the ring the father uses to stamp on all of his official documents. My goodness. The son who squandered one-third of the family wealth is now being put in charge of managing what's left. Tax collectors are going to be leaders in the kingdom of God. Sinners are going to manage the church. There's more, another surprise. Quick, put sandals on his feet. Slaves went barefoot, children wore shoes. There's more, another surprise. Quick, bring the fattened calf and kill it. The fattened calf is reserved for the highest of guests, the most special guests. The highest honor in the Middle East you can give a visitor is to kill the fattened calf. Sinners and tax collectors worthy of killing the fattened calf? Honored guest at the honor at a meal with the Holy One. There's more. One more surprise. Quick, let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was lost and he's been found. He was dead and he's alive. Jesus knows a rejoicing father, a feast-making father who throws a party when sinners come home. Everything the father does in this parable is unexpected and culturally scandalous, just as everything Jesus does with sinners and tax collectors is unexpected and culturally scandalous. Jesus defends his scandalous actions by the even more scandalous claim that in him, the Holy One is welcoming sinners. In Jesus, the Holy God embraces tax collectors and sinners. It's the embrace that makes us holy. Do you believe that? The Holy One risks his reputation in order to embrace sinners. It's the grace of one who only acts in ways that honors his name. So here's the good news, which people all over this globe are longing to hear. In the incarnation, the living and holy God lifts the hem of his robe and runs toward lost sinners. At the cross, the living and holy God takes upon himself all the shame of the unholy and rejoices as he does it. So what if some of the religious folk think God is thereby tarnishing his reputation? All that matters to God is that children came home. And besides, this is now the reputation. This is now the name the holy God has in the world. This man welcomes sinners and he eats with them. Brothers and sisters, it's safe to come home. It doesn't matter what you have done or not done. It doesn't matter what you have done or not done since the last time you heard this parable. Just come home. Just turn around and come home. Oh, sure, some of the older brothers and sisters might hassle you and might demand that you measure up first, but that's because the older brothers and sisters have forgotten grace. And besides, the only opinion that now matters is the Father's. And Jesus, who comes from the heart of the Father, tells us, it's safe to come home. Why do you think Jesus dies in the posture that he dies, with his arms outstretched? Because those outstretched arms of Jesus are the outstretched arms of the Father. I tell you, it's safe to come home. We will be welcomed with scandalous love.